Dilemma the 57th. Why have adahats no power over their bodies? Venerable Nagasena, your members of the order say there is one kind of pain only which an adahat suffers, bodily pain, that is, and not mental. How is this, Nagasena, that adahat keeps his mind going by means of the body? Has the adahat no lordship, no mastery, no power over the body? No, he has not. Okay. That, sir, is not right, that over the body by which he keeps his mind going, he should have neither lordship, nor mastery, nor power. Even a bird, sir, is lord and master and ruler over the nest in which he dwells. There are these 10 qualities, O king, inherent in the body, which run after it, as it were, and accompany it, from existence to existence. And what are the 10? Cold and heat, hunger and thirst, the necessity of voiding excreta, fatigue and sleepiness, old age, disease and death. And in respect thereof, the adahat is without lordship, without mastery, without power. Venerable Nagasena, what is the reason why the commands of the adahat have no power over his body, neither has he any mastery over it? Tell me that. Just, O king, as whatever beings are dependent on the land, they all walk and dwell, and carry on their business and dependence upon it. But do their commands have force? Does their mastery extend over it? Certainly not, sir. Just so, O king, the adahat keeps his mind going through the body, and yet his commands have no authority over it, nor power. Venerable Nagasena, why is it that the ordinary man suffers both bodily and mental pain? By reason, O king, of the untrained state of his mind. Just, O king, as an ox, when trembling with starvation, might be tied up with a weak and fragile and tiny rope of grass or creeper. But if the ox were excited, then would he escape, dragging the fastening with him? Just so, O king, when pain comes upon him whose mind is untrained, then is his mind excited, and the mind so excited bends his body this way and that and makes it grovel on the ground. And he, being thus untrained in mind, trembles and cries and gives forth terrible groans. That is why the ordinary man, O king, suffers pain as well in body as in mind. Then why, sir, does the adahat only suffer one kind of pain, bodily that is, and not mental? The mind of the adahat, O king, is trained, well practiced, tamed, brought into subjection and obedient, and it hearkens to his word. When affected with feelings of pain, he grasps firmly the idea of the impermanence of all things, so ties his mind, as it were, to the post of contemplation, and his mind, bound to the post of contemplation, remains unmoved, unshaken, becomes steadfast, wanders not through his body, the while may bend this way and that and roll in agony by the disturbing influence of the pain. This is why it is only one kind of pain that the adahat suffers, bodily pain, that is, and not mental. Venerable Nagasena, that verily is a most marvelous thing, that when the body is trembling and mind should not be shaken. Give me a reason for that. Suppose, O king, there were a noble tree, mighty in trunk and branches and leaves, and when agitated by the force of the wind, its branches should wave. Would the trunk also move? Certainly not, sir. Well, O king, the mind of the adahat is as the trunk of that noble tree. most wonderful Nagasena and most strange. Never before have I seen a lamp of the law that burned thus brightly through all time. Here ends the dilemma as to the Arahat's power over his body. Dilemma, the 58th, the layman's sin. Venerable Nagasena, suppose a layman had been guilty of a paragika offense, and some time after should enter the order, and neither he himself should be aware that when still a layman, he had been so guilty, nor should anyone else inform him, saying, when a layman, you were guilty of such an offense. Now if he were to devote himself to the attainment of arahatship, would he be able so to comprehend the truth as to succeed in entering upon the excellent way? No, O King, he would not. But why not, sir? That in him which might have been the cause of his grasping of the truth has been in him destroyed. No comprehension can therefore take place. Venerable Nagasena, your people say, to him who is aware of an offense, there comes remorse. When remorse has arisen, there is an obstruction in the heart. To him whose heart is obstructed, there is no comprehension of the truth. Why should there then be no such comprehension to one not aware of his offense, feeling no remorse, remaining with a quiet heart? This dilemma touches on two irreconcilable statements. Think well before you solve it. Would selected seed, O King, successfully sown in a well-plowed, well-watered, fertile soil come to maturity? Certainly, sir. But would the same seed grow on the surface of a thick slab of rock? Of course not. Why then should the same seed grow in the mud and not on the rock? Because on the rock, the cause for its growth does not exist. Seeds cannot grow without a cause. Just so, O King, the cause by reason of which his comprehension of the truth, his conversion, might have been brought about, has been rooted out of him. Conversion cannot take place without a cause. Give me, sir, another simile. Well, O King, will sticks and clods and cudgels and clubs find a resting place in the air in the same way as they do on the ground? No, sir. But what is the reason why they come to rest on the earth when they will not stand in the air? There is no cause in the air for their stability, and without a cause, they will not stand. Just so, O King. By that fault of his, the cause for his conversion has been removed, and without a cause, there can be no conversion. Now will fire, O King, burn in water in the same way as it will on land? No, sir. But why not? Because in water, the conditions precedent for burning do not exist, and there can be no burning without them. Just so, O King. Are the conditions precedent to conversion destroyed in him by that offense of his? And when the conditions which would bring it about are destroyed, there can be no conversion. Venerable Nagasena, think over this matter once more. I am not yet convinced about it. Persuade me by some reason how such obstruction can occur in the case of one not aware of his offense, and feeling, therefore, no remorse. Would the halahala poison, O King, if eaten by a man who did not know he had eaten it, take away his life? Yes, sir. Just so, O King, there is an obstruction to his comprehension of the truth, who without being aware of it, has committed a sin. And would fire, O King, burn a man who walked to it unawares? Yes, sir. Well, just so in the case you put,
Or would a venomous snake, if it bit a man without his knowing it, kill him?
Yes, sir.
Well, just so, in the case you put. And it's not true that Samana Kolana, the king of Kalinga, when surrounded by the seven treasures of a sovereign overlord, he went mounted on his state elephant to pay a visit to his relatives, was not able to pass the Tree of Wisdom, though he was not aware that it was there. Well, of the same kind is the reason why one who has committed an offense, even though he know it not, is nevertheless incapable of rising to the knowledge of the truth.
Verily, Nagasena, this must be the word of the conqueror. To find any fault with it were vain, and this explanation of yours must be the meaning of it. I accept it as you say.
Here ends the dilemma of the layman's sin. Dilemma, the 59th, the guilty recluse.
Venerable Nagasena, what is the distinction? What the difference between a layman who has done wrong and a samana, member of the order who has done wrong? Will they both be reborn in like condition? Will the like retribution happen to both? Or is there any difference?
There are, O King, 10 qualities which abound in the guilty samana, distinguishing him from the guilty layman. And besides that, in 10 ways does the samana purify the gift that may be given to him. And what are the 10 qualities which abound in the guilty samana, distinguishing him from the guilty layman? The guilty samana, O King, is full of reverence for the Buddha, for the law, for the order, and for his fellow disciples. He exerts himself in putting questions about and in recitation of the sacred text. He is devoted to learning. Though he has done wrong, then, O King, the guilty one, entering the assembly, enters it. Decently clad, he guards himself alike in body and mind. Through fear of rebuke, his mind is set upon exerting himself towards the attainment of arahatship. He is of the companionship of the brethren, and even, O King, if he does wrong, he lives discreetly, just, O King, as a married woman sins only in secret and in privacy, so does the guilty samana walk discreetly in his wrongdoing. These are the 10 qualities, O King, found in the guilty samana, distinguishing him from the guilty layman. And what are the 10 ways in which, besides, he purifies the gift given to him? He purifies it in that he wears an invulnerable coat of mail, in that he is shorn in the fashion of the characteristic mark of renunciation used by the seers of old, in that he is one who is included in the multitude of the brethren, in that he has taken his refuge in the Buddha, the law, and the order, in that he dwells in a lonely spot suitable for the exertion after arahatship, in that he seeks after the treasure of the teaching of the conquerors, in that he preaches the most excellent law, Dhamma, in that his final destiny is to be reborn in the island of truth, in that he is possessed of an honest belief that the Buddha is the chief of all beings, in that he has taken upon himself the keeping of the Uposatha day. These, O King, are the 10 ways in which, besides, he purifies the gift given to him. Even, O King, when thoroughly fallen, a guilty samana yet sanctifies the gift of the supporters of the faith, just as water, however thick, will wash away slush and mud, dirt and stains, just as hot and even boiling water will put a mighty blazing fire out, just as food, however nasty, will allay the faintness of hunger. For thus, O King, hath it been said by the God over all gods in the most excellent Magima Nikaya in the chapter on gifts. Whenever a good man with believing heart presents what he hath earned in righteousness to the unrighteous in full confidence on the great fruit to follow the good act, such gift is by the giver sanctified.
Most wonderful Nagasena, and most strange, we ask you a mere ordinary question and you expounding it with reasons and with similes, have filled, as it were, the hearer with the sweet taste of the nectar of Nirvana, just as a cook or a cook's apprentice taking a piece of ordinary nutmeg, while treating it with various ingredients, prepare a dish for a king. So, Nagasena, when we ask you an ordinary question, have you expounding it with reasons and similes, filled the hearer with the sweet taste of the nectar of Nirvana? Here ends the dilemma as to the guilty recluse. Dilemma the 60th. The soul in water. Venerable Nagasena, this water, when boiling over the fire, gives forth many a sound, hissing and simmering. Is then, Nagasena, the water alive? Is it shouting at play? Or is it crying out at the torment inflicted on it? It is not alive, O King. There is no soul or being in water. It is by reason of the greatness of the shock of the heat of the fire that it gives forth sounds, hissing and simmering. Now, Venerable Nagasena, there are false teachers who, on the ground that the water is alive, reject the use of cold water, and warming the water, feed themselves on tepid foods of various kinds. These men find fault with you and revile you, saying, "The Sakya Putiya Samanas do injury to the souls of one function, dispel, remove, get rid of this, their censure and blame." The water is not alive, O King, neither is there therein either soul or being, and it is the great shock of the heat of the fire that makes it sound, hissing and simmering. It is like the water in holes in the ground, in ponds, and pools and lakes, in reservoirs, in crevices and chasms in wells, in low-lying places, and in lotus tanks, which before the mighty onset of the hot winds is so deeply affected that it vanishes away. But does the water in that case, O King, give forth many a sound, hissing and simmering? Certainly not, sir. But if it were alive, the water would then also make some sound. Know, therefore, O King, that there is no soul, neither being in water, and that it is the greatness of the shock of the heat of the water that makes it give forth sounds. And here another reason, O King, for the same thing. If water, O King, with grains of rice in it, is put in a vessel and covered up, but not placed over the fireplace, would it then give forth a sound? No, sir. It would remain quiet and unmoved. But if you were to put the same water, just as it is in the vessel, over a fireplace, and then light up the fire, would the water remain quiet and motionless? Certainly not, sir. It would move and be agitated, become perturbed and all in commotion. Waves would arise in it. It would rush up and down in every direction. It would roll up and boil over, and a garland of foam would be formed above it. But why so, O King, when water, in its ordinary state, remains quiet and motionless? It is because of the powerful impulse of the heat of the fire that the water, usually so still, gives forth a many sound, bubbling and hissing. And thereby know, O King, that there is no soul in water, neither being, and that it is the strong heat of the fire that causes it to make sounds. And here another reason, O King, for the same thing. Is there not water to be found in every house put into water pots with their mouths closed up? Yes, sir. Well,
Does that water move? Is it agitated, perturbed, in commotion? Does it form into waves? Does it rush up and down in every direction? Does it roll up and roll over? Is it covered with foam? No, that water is in its ordinary state. It remains still and quiet. But have you ever heard that all this is true of the water in the great ocean, and that rearing up it breaks against the strand with a mighty roar? Yes, I have both heard of it, and have seen it myself, how the water in the great ocean lifts itself up 100, 200 cubits high towards the sky. But why, whereas water in its ordinary state remains motionless and still, does the water in the ocean both move and roar? That is by reason of the mighty force of the onset of the wind, whereas the water in the water jars neither moves nor makes any noise because nothing shakes it. Well, the sounds given forth by boiling water are the result in a similar way of the great heat of the fire. Do not people cover over the dried up mouth of a drum with dried cow leather? Yes, they do. Well, is there any soul or being, O King, in a drum? Certainly not, sir. Then how is it that a drum makes sounds? By the action or effort of a woman or a man. Well, just as that is why the drum sounds, so is it by the effect of the heat of the fire that the water sounds. And for this reason also you might know, O King, that there is no soul, neither being in water, and that it is the heat of the fire which causes it to make sounds. And I too, O King, have something yet further to ask of you. Thus shall this puzzle be thoroughly threshed out. How is it? Is it true of every kind of vessel that water heated in it makes noises, or only of some kinds of vessels? Not of all, sir, only of some. But then you have yourself, O King, abandoned the positions you took up. You have come over to my side that there is no soul, neither being in water, for only if it made noises in whatever vessel it were heated, could it be right to say that it had a soul? There cannot be two kinds of water, that which speaks, as it were, which is alive, and that which does not speak and does not live. If all water were alive, then that which the great elephants, when they are in rut, suck up in their trunks and pour out over their towering frames, or putting into their mouths, take right into their stomachs. That water, too, when crushed flat between their teeth, would make a sound. And great ships, 100 cubits long, heavily laden, full of hundreds of packages of goods, pass over the sea. The water, crushed by them too, would make sounds. And mighty fish, leviathans, with bodies hundreds of leagues long, since they dwell in the great ocean, immersed in the depth of it, must, so living in it, be constantly taking into their mouths and spouting out the ocean, and that water too, crushed between their gills or in their stomach, would make sounds. But as, even when tormented with the grinding and crushing of all such mighty things, the water gives no sound, therefore, O King, you may take it that there is no soul, neither being in water.
Very good, Nagasena. With fitting discrimination has the puzzle put to you been solved. Just, Nagasena, as a gem of inestimable value which had come into the hands of an able master goldsmith, clever and well trained, would meet with due appreciation, estimation, and praise just as a rare pearl at the hands of a dealer in pearls, a fine piece of woven stuff at the hands of a cloth merchant, or red sandalwood at the hands of a perfumer. Just so, in that way, has this puzzle put to you been solved,
with the discrimination it deserved. Here ends the dilemma as to the water life. Here ends the sixth chapter.